Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Kate Hunter. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling in to Cigna's 2013 Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Hunter, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team with Cigna. Due to the format of the call today, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, you'll be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are asking for your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After that survey is completed, you will have an opportunity to ask questions of today's speakers. A handout for today's presentation is available online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Eating Disorders, an Epidemic. Again, visit the Awareness Series page online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Eating Disorders, an Epidemic. Please also notice the blue square in the top section of that webpage that you may click on to sign up for future seminars. It's not required that you sign up in order to attend the monthly seminars. However, if you choose to do so, you will receive an email reminder for each month's presentation. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing Megan Moran and Alicia Contner-Wilkins. Megan Moran is a registered dietitian, and Alicia Contner-Wilkins is a licensed therapist and a program director at Blue Horizons Eating Disorder Services. Today, they will be sharing information with us on emerging trends and treatment planning for eating disorders. Welcome, Megan and Alicia.
Thank you, Kate. Good afternoon to those of you on the West Coast, and good afternoon to those of you on the East Coast, and good morning to those of you on the West Coast, and welcome to all in between. And thank you for attending our presentation on eating disorders and epidemic. A few points we want to make sure to cover today. We want to help you understand the basic diagnoses in eating disorder treatment. Therapists diagnose according to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And in May of this year, we welcomed a fifth edition. So all clinicians are getting up to speed with learning the new format. We welcome this new format because it will now take less criteria to meet a formal diagnosis for some disorders, thus increasing access to treatment. We want to help you understand media coin terminology, emerging trends. We want to provide definitions, statistics, and care plan information for these emerging trends. And we want to provide education on eating disorders in the pediatric population. So where do eating disorders come from? Eating disorders do not come from any one place, any one person, any one thing. They come from a variety of influences. We are certainly seeing an increase of social pressures and images in the media. The average American is exposed to 3,000 images daily. Due to the technological speed with which messages are now delivered, the American Academy of Pediatrics indicates that children are spending an average of 7 hours per day watching television, on phones, not to mention smartphones and other electronic devices. So we are certainly seeing social pressure cause an influence in eating disorders. We're seeing an influx of images of perfection and narrow definitions of beauty from the media. According to Dr. Linda Smolak, the average woman is 5'4" and weighs 140 pounds. The average model is 5'11" and weighs 117 pounds. Most fashion models are thinner than 98% of American women. So keep in mind when you're looking at these images what is realistic. And also biological influences. More and more research is being done on the genetic influences in eating disorders. 50 to 80% are determined by genetics. 12 times more likely to develop anorexia nervosa if a family member has already been diagnosed with this illness, and 4 times more likely to develop bulimia nervosa, again, if a family member has been diagnosed with this illness. These behaviors can alter brain chemistry and exacerbate eating disorders. Taking a look at the next slide, now let's spend a little bit of time going through some of our diagnostic criteria. So with anorexia nervosa, when we think of someone with anorexia nervosa, we think of someone who is below a certain weight relative to their height, bone structure, and their genetics. Anorexia is defined as the restriction of intake relative to requirements, resulting in low body weight in the context of age, sex, developmental trajectory, and physical health. According to the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the new diagnoses also include attitudes and behaviors previously not considered to meet the criteria for an official diagnosis. We also want to look for intense fear of weight gain, distorted body image, unusual eating behaviors, we call these rituals, and an intense preoccupation with food, weight, and body image. And we also want to look for behavioral and emotional issues such as depression and social isolation. Taking a look at the next slide, DSM-5 changes to anorexia. Amenorrhea no longer included in the diagnostic criteria. Amenorrhea is the loss of a menstrual cycle, whereas in the DSM-4, you had to have a loss of 3 consecutive menstrual cycles to make a diagnosis. Some women maintained a cycle due to artificially generated menstrual cycles due to contraception. So we're no longer having to take that into account. Weight criteria is now more reflective of changes in weight rather than meeting a strict below 85% of ideal body weight. So at times we also see those who have lost a significant amount of weight in a short period of time, and now we are able to treat those individuals and diagnose them with anorexia nervosa, thus increasing access to treatment. This now allows for people who are obese and overweight prior to the onset of anorexia symptoms to be classified with the disorder before reaching a critically low body weight. Now let's move on to bulimia nervosa. Historically, when we think of bulimia nervosa, we think of someone who engages in binge purge behaviors. We see recurrent episodes of binge eating. Binge episodes in the previous diagnostic manual used to be 2 times a week for at least 3 months. The new diagnostic manual allows individuals to be diagnosed with this illness when they binge at least 1 time a week and for the same amount of time, the 3-month period of time. We also see self-induced vomiting, laxative use, excessive exercise, or strict dieting following binge episodes. These are what we call purging or compensatory mechanisms, and they are used to make up for the calories in which the individual has taken in. Again, we see a fear of weight gain. We see secretive behavior around food and eating. Typically, these behaviors are engaged in isolation. We also see persistent over-concern with weight and appearance, and we also see depression and moodiness. Moving on to the next slide. So what is new to the DSM-5? So other eating disorders that we now see in the DSM-5 include ARFID, and that stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. I know that's certainly a mouthful. These are individuals who have developed a problem with eating, or for children, those that have feeding issues. And these issues cause the person to not take in enough calories or nutrition for his or her diet. So ARFID is expected to capture up to 50% of the patients that were previously classified as EDNOS, or eating disorder not otherwise specified, and these were the individuals who did not meet full criteria for anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa. They were lumped under this category. Individuals that had binge eating disorder behaviors were also lumped under EDNOS, and now binge eating disorder is now its own diagnostic category, and we are hoping that more individuals as well will be able to receive treatment for this disorder. Other specified feeding or eating disorder, atypical anorexia falls under this category. This is when all criteria for anorexia is met. However, the weight is in or above normal range. Bulimia nervosa or binge eating disorder without frequency or duration requirements. So somebody may be binging and or purging for less than 1 time a week and for less than 3 months. They now will meet this criteria. And then purging disorder. Those are individuals who purge without the binging behavior and typically maintain a normal weight. Unspecified feeding or eating disorder, Symptoms here may be characteristic of feeding and eating disorder and have clinical significance, but does not meet full criteria. For instance, this disorder may encompass those individuals, for instance, and we've seen this before, who have clinically significant symptoms but do not meet the full criteria, again, for a formal diagnosis. So moving on to the next slide, ARFID further defined. Individuals, again, with a refusal to maintain minimally appropriate weight but do not experience body image distress. Again, you would not take someone into account for this diagnosis who has a medical condition, or maybe they do not have access to food because of a socioeconomic status. All criteria for bulimia or nervosa, but the frequency of the binges or compensatory behaviors do not meet the frequency criterion or less than the last 3 months, as was mentioned before. Binge eating disorder, again, has its own diagnosis currently. These are recurrent episodes of binge eating in the absence of regular other inappropriate compensatory behaviors characteristic of bulimia or nervosa. So, again, these are individuals who just engage in the binging and not the purging piece that goes along with bulimia nervosa. And ARFID also includes the pediatric feeding disorders. In the DSM-IV, there was a separate category for kids and infants who had feeding disorders, but it really limited this population because the diagnosis had to be made prior to the age of six. So with the new DSM, we're hoping that it can help us to fill in some of the gaps and better understand those who lose weight or do not gain weight as expected. Other issues that can occur or co-occur at the same time as ARFID, some associated disorders, looking at the next slide, are anxiety disorders, obsessive-compulsive disorder, neurodevelopmental disorders such as autism spectrum, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or intellectual disability, reactive attachment disorder, and just to give you a brief definition, that is when infants and children do not establish healthy bonds or relationships with parents or caregivers. I worked a long time in the foster care system, and we saw this a lot with the children and adolescents with whom we worked. Phobias, social anxiety disorder, major depressive disorder, schizophrenia spectrum disorders. This is a new term for various schizophrenia types. Those characterized by hallucinations, delusions, distorted thoughts and speech, emotional and behavioral issues, and lastly, factitious disorder. The word factitious meaning artificial in Latin. These are individuals who create or exaggerate symptoms of an illness due to an inner need to demonstrate this type of behavior for attention and not for concrete reasons, such as financial. Moving on to the next slide, let's talk a little bit about the epidemiology of eating disorders. Eating disorders affect 5 to 10% of females in the United States. An estimated 10% of these cases are males. We are certainly now seeing an increase in the male population, which Megan will cover a little bit later. Eating disorders affect all socioeconomic groups. Eating disorders do not discriminate. In adults, there is a 40-to-1 female-to-male ratio. In adolescents, there is a 10-to-1 female-to-male ratio. And in children, ages 5 to 12, there is a 5-to-1 female-to-male ratio, and we certainly do not want to forget our male population in our statistics. So where are we today with eating disorders? More and more research continues to be conducted, and more clinicians are receiving training. Approximately 5 to 17 million people suffer from anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa. Approximately 90% of those are women. 43% report the age of onset between 16 and 20 years old. So again, that college age population. 86% report the age of onset by the age of 20. And during the early 80s, the average age of onset increased from 19.3 to 22.2. The incidence of a bulimia nervosa in women ages 10 to 39 tripled between 1988 to 1993. And this is a statistic by the National Eating Disorder Association. We are seeing an increase in women in midlife develop eating disorders. For instance, one of our treatment centers in South Florida saw an increase in the early 2000s in the admission rates of women over the age of 30 to their residential and inpatient programs. Anorexia is more common in women between the ages of 25 to 35. Continuing on, the majority of patients with bulimia nervosa are in their 20s. Dr. Richard Kripe, a specialist in adolescent medicine, says that the number of patients with eating disorder not otherwise specified has almost doubled nationally. And again, EDNOS is previously a category reserved for those who did not meet full criteria. Presently, 75% of eating disorder cases, and we expect to see the statistic change with new DSM criteria. Initial research at the University of Florida shows that of 396 disordered eaters, 14% were diagnosed with anorexia nervosa utilizing the DSM-4 criteria, and 20% were diagnosed with anorexia nervosa utilizing the new DSM-5 criteria. Bulimia nervosa statistics remain the same at 18%, and 68% of those diagnosed with EDNOS according to the DSM-4, of those, 8% were diagnosed with binge eating disorder. So again, binge eating disorder being its own category, those individuals are now going to get more specific treatment based on the criteria in the DSM-5. ARFID is expected to help diagnose individuals who until now have been considered EDNOS. So again, getting a little bit more specific with diagnosing. And moving on to emerging trends, I want to enlighten you with some of these media coined terms. So these are not official diagnostic categories. These, again, are terms coined by the media out there. And, again, Megan's going to give you a little bit more detailed information on each of these, including definitions, health consequences, risks, and care plans. So let's just go through the terms. Diabulimia, drunkorexia, orthorexia, eating disorders in males, such as muscle dysmorphia, bigorexia, and reverse anorexia, and eating disorders in the childbearing years, pregorexia, and desperate housewife syndrome. So hopefully these terms have caught your attention a little bit, and I'm now going to turn the next few slides over to Megan.
And we'll go ahead and start with diabulimia first today. And as you can see, this refers to people with type 1 diabetes who intentionally avoid taking their insulin in an attempt to stay or become thin. And unfortunately, about 40% of females with type 1 diabetes have actually admitted to using insulin manipulation to control their weight. So this is something when we first had our program open that we didn't see quite as often, and gradually over the years we're seeing this as becoming more and more common. In type 1 diabetes, you most often are diagnosed in adolescence. It's an autoimmune disorder where your pancreas can't produce enough insulin, which prevents your body's cells from using glucose for energy. So basically what happens is when you're eating, you're building up a lot of glucose or blood sugar in your blood. And when it raises to a level that's too high, it has to be removed from your body as waste in your urine. So when cells can't use glucose for energy or storage, patients often experience weight loss before they're diagnosed as they're losing it through their urine. So, again, they're typically adolescents, and when they're diagnosed, they're taught to manage their diabetes and their blood sugar by using insulin shots or pumps and checking their blood sugar regularly. In addition to that, they're working with a dietitian often to read labels, to count carbohydrates, to make sure they understand how much insulin is needed to administer several times a day every time they eat. So there's this heightened interest in food. There's this heightened interest in knowledge of food in order to manage your disease at the same time as this typical kind of adolescent development socially. Once the insulin regimen begins at this time, the cells immediately begin to use that sugar, that glucose, in the blood for energy or storage. So what would the result of that be? Often weight gain. And it can be as much as 20 pounds in the first week. So they're losing weight. We make a diagnosis, teach them to use insulin to manage their blood sugars, and that comes with a rapid increase in weight during a really difficult transitional time. So we can kind of see the concoction of how this diabulimia term has been coined to become more popular. Unfortunately, if it is unaddressed, excess glucose or sugar in your blood can have devastating and oftentimes deadly effects. The most common ones here are going to be severe damage to your kidneys and your nerves, which cause numbness or tingling in your hands and your feet. It's also the leading cause of new onset blindness in the United States every year. It can be a precursor for cardiovascular illness as well, and electrolyte imbalances, and even diabetic ketoacidosis, which basically means that your blood sugar gets so high your body has to break down fats in order to still function, and that can come with vomiting, loss of consciousness, fatigue, dehydration, and breaking down of the muscular tissue. So if you look at the next slide and look at the mortality rates of diabulimia, they're quite alarming. 2.5% have type 1 diabetes, 6.5% have anorexia nervosa, and then 34.8% mortality rate for concurrent diagnosis of both type 1 diabetes and anorexia nervosa. So you can see that the likelihood that you can actually die from both of these illnesses is 5 times higher than just an eating disorder alone. And in addition to that, those with type 1 diabetes, particularly females, they're twice as likely as those without diabetes to develop an eating disorder. And again, between the need to count carbohydrates and focus on food labels, in addition to a weight gain that is very sudden and uncomfortable, at a crucial point in social and physical development, it makes this a really difficult disease to manage at this time. So if we look at the care plan, something that I would say now that you'll see across the spectrum of these different epidemics kind of coming up in these different media coined terms is an interdisciplinary approach is critical. Treatment is a really delicate process with diabulimia. Patients have to learn to manage both diseases effectively. And in an eating disorder, we can actually see full recovery. But with diabetes, it's chronic, and so we have to learn to deal with this on a daily basis. So who would be a part of that care team? Typically an endocrinologist. Oftentimes a psychiatrist with them so that they can also regularly follow their blood work and their vitals and their labs, and then a nutrition care plan to include both the diabetes and the eating disorder management. Traditional eating disorder approaches tries to stay away from counting and over-focus on food, but unfortunately to manage the diabetes, we can't steer away from that. We really have to help these patients learn to be able to manage that in a healthier way. And then a therapist as well, and oftentimes we see that to include acceptance of the chronic disease of diabetes, identity outside of that disease, social barriers associated with diabetes, and finally being more empowered with diabetes.
Moving on to the next slide, let's talk a little bit about drunkorexia. I remember when I first saw this term, again, it wasn't on the news, it wasn't in one of my clinical journals, it was in an Oprah magazine. And it was probably in the late 90s, early 2000s. So this is something that we are seeing prevalent in the college age population. Drunkorexia is characterized by self-imposed starvation or binging and purging combined with alcohol abuse. We'll talk a little bit about that as we move further down the slide. This is a slightly misleading term, as alcohol abuse is more common with bulimia. So when you look at that word drunkorexia, we tend to focus more on the orexia part of drunkorexia. And again, that is misleading. Alcohol use and abuse is more common with bulimics because bulimics tend to engage in more risk-taking behaviors. And why is that? Anorexics, you have to think, are going to be a little bit more leery of alcohol consumption because of the calories. Now, some anorexics, however, may use alcohol to help them relax, to make it easier for them to consume food and to decrease anxiety maybe in some social situations as well. Alcohol may be the only calories consumed all day. Again, this is a little bit more characteristic of some of our anorexics. The alcohol may be a way to numb some of the emotional pain. It's used as a method to manage weight and continue drinking. And it also may be an excuse for self-induced vomiting. You know, think of the individual that maybe presents to your office and they say, well, you know, I'm not purging purposely, I'm just drinking an excess, and it's the alcohol that is making me throw up. So they're using the alcohol as justification for their purging behaviors. Moving on to the next slide. Again, this is prevalent in the college-aged binge drinkers who often starve during the day to offset the calories through alcohol and decrease time to feel the effects. So, you know, the alcohol will get into my system a lot quicker and I will experience intoxication much quicker if I don't eat all day long. A true alcoholic may want to feel the effects of the alcohol sooner. So again, one offsets the calories by not eating during the day. Bulimics typically binge on food and alcohol and then follow with a purge. And the anorexics use alcohol to ease the anxiety around food or being uncomfortable in certain food environments or even social environments. Our anorexics, again, tend to be a little bit less social, a little bit more engaged, a little bit more isolated. So this helps to bring them out of their shell, so to speak. Moving on to the health risks of engaging in this behavior, again, you've got the eating disorder now coupled with alcohol use as well, which certainly can be detrimental to the body. Restriction of necessary nutrients. Obviously, one cannot live on a diet of alcohol alone. Disruptive sleep cycles. The misnomer here is that, well, the alcohol helps to relax me. But really, the alcohol interferes with one's REM sleep or their deep sleep cycles. And we need sleep for our bodies to repair themselves. Hence, it inhibits the building and restoration of muscle tissue. This primarily occurs, again, when one is in these deep sleep cycles. It causes irritation of stomach lining with increased risk of ulcers and heartburn and liver issues in addition. And less overall tolerance to alcohol with restricted food intake. So again, it takes less and less alcohol over time to see some of these effects. Looking at recent study results, alcohol problems occur in 9 to 55% in bulimia nervosa and in 0 to 19% of anorexia nervosa. There is a positive correlation with the development of alcohol use disorder in those with eating disorders. Purgers report heavier alcohol consumption than non-purgers, and part of this is because that they know that they will compensate for the alcohol use by later purging in the day. There's also a positive correlation between severe dieting and the prevalence and intensity of alcohol use. Looking at the next slide, drunkorexia does not carry any official statistics, and again, it's not a research-based diagnosis that you would see in our diagnostic manual. CBS News has estimated that drunkorexia affects 30% of 18 to 23-year-olds. And remember that in 86%, the age of onset is by the age of 20 years old. So how do we treat this population? As Megan mentioned, we want to work with a treatment team. When working with any eating disorder, we want to emphasize working with a team. And at a minimum, a team includes a dietitian, a therapist, and a physician. But when we get into some of these emerging trends, there are going to be additional members of the team that will be required. So a care plan should provide nutrition and psychoeducation referring to the dangers of this behavior. We want to educate on eating disorders, and we want to educate, certainly, on excessive alcohol consumption. We want to move this individual towards a normal relationship with food. And we want to teach alternative methods to relax and cope rather than using alcohol and rather than using the eating disorder. Therapy should focus on the addiction simultaneously, and now this is dependent on the therapeutic model that is used. Some models of therapy believe that the addiction, the alcohol use, should be addressed first and in isolation. Some believe that the eating disorder should be addressed first. And some, frankly, believe in treating it all at the same time. However, time is certainly of the essence here because there is certainly more medical risk to someone with drunkorexia due to the two disorders that have now become combined.
And so we'll move forward with the next one, and that's called orthorexia. This has become much more popular, I believe, now just with such a high emphasis on nutrition and that nutrition can prevent disease and it can cure disease and that just how powerful that food is. And really what orthorexia is an unhealthy obsession with health food, or an unhealthy obsession with being healthy. It's a newer form of disordered eating, and there's not as much, well, there's really no emphasis on weight or body image, which makes it a little different than anorexia. However, there's this just this fixation on only eating healthy or pure foods. The restricting is based on the perceived quality of the food versus the quantity. So this food needs to be pure, it needs to be righteous, it needs to be healthy, it needs to be organic versus such small portions like an anorexia. There's almost like a moralizing tone to orthorexia, like they may consider it like a religion. Again, it's just this preoccupation. You can see here some of the warning signs that are listed. Sufferers can really spend up to hours to prepare one meal, or even days if foods must be fermented or sprouted. They may feel very virtuous about the food, but they don't actually ever take pleasure in their food. They're continually eliminating acceptable foods. Some of the most common ones that I've seen are animal products, processed foods, artificial ingredients, preservatives, foods that are not organic. And we really see people fall more and more susceptible, again, as we're seeing more and more in the media about how all of these different parts of food can hurt you, whether it's MSG, whether it's high fructose corn syrup. And so as a culture, we're becoming more and more fearful of food. This can obviously create social isolation due to food. We can't eat and gather with others when our diet is so limited to only a few foods that are actually okay for us to consume. Also being critical of others who do not eat healthy, eliminating foods that we once enjoyed. That's an easy way for me to be able to screen as a dietitian when working with a patient. What foods did you used to eat? You know, here you have listed the same 10 foods every day, but how did you used to eat? We also commonly see guilt or self-loathing if they stray from their diet, and feeling in total control of eating the correct food. And I think that word control kind of stands out to me here as this sort of illness manifests around this need to stay in control of their food and health at all times. So how is it disordered? Oftentimes this is a difficult one to touch on as a dietitian because they'll come in and say, I'm so healthy, everyone's praising me because I'm just so dedicated to being healthy. When needing to eat and to eat a certain way becomes the primary focus in your life and begins to unravel other areas of your life, that's how we see that this is now distorted. It can cause social isolation or excessive exercise in order to balance eating. And it can lead to malnutrition through the restriction of the following: fat, preservatives, organic only, animal products, only raw foods. The concerning part with orthorexia is that this population knows that they're too thin, but they're not able to gain weight because the food is too unhealthy. So it's kind of a catch-22. The treatment for this really focuses on the anxiety leading to the orthorexic behaviors, and so working with a therapist on how to manage that anxiety and that sense of need for control, and then working with a dietitian to establish a healthy relationship with food. And a lot of that is simply working through nutrition education and teaching the patient what is healthy, what does that look like, what does that mean, what is the reality behind all of these things that you're reading on the internet, and what is the truth of them as far as their actual nutrition. And then we'll move forward into eating disorders in males. It's actually interesting. The body dissatisfaction now is actually equal with men and women. It's just two different types. You know, with men we're seeing, and you can see in these terms here, that there's this desire to be big, to have muscles, versus women there's this desire to be very, very thin. So here, muscle dysmorphia, bigorexia, and reverse anorexia. And basically, like I said, they kind of are self-explanatory. This need to just become bigger, that you're never muscular enough, you're never lean enough, and you're never comfortable in your own body. So it's kind of the opposite of anorexia. And binge eating disorder is also incredibly common in males as well. So if we look at some of the estimates today, recent estimates actually show that there's about 4 to 6 million men struggling with eating disorder. So this is moving rapidly, as you can see, from over 1 million men back in 2008. Harvard studies estimate 25% of eating disorder adults are males. So 13 years ago, we saw that there was about 1 in 10. that were actually males with an eating disorder. And now we're seeing this 250% estimated increase as we're looking at about 25% of all eating disorders to be men. And the typical onset of this is about 12 to 15 years old. So why the recent increase? There's a lot of different speculations about the socio-cultural demands placed on male body image, and obviously the advertising and just changes in the media. Back in the 50s, about 3% of male models were not dressed, versus in the 90s, about 35% of male models were not dressed. The male body in advertising is worth billions. They even recently did an action figure study. They looked at G.I. Joe, Batman, Luke Skywalker, the Wolverine, and looked at the changes in these action figures from 1973 to 1998, and I'll review briefly with you the results of that. The chest dimensions had changed from 44.4 inches to 54.8 inches. Biceps went from 12 inches to 26 inches. The waist went from 35.5 inches to 31.7 inches, and the abdominal muscles were much more defined. So you can see not only is it the action figures and the male models, but everyone is becoming more and more lean and muscular, more and more fit over the last 25 years. So if you look at the next slide, some of the findings in males, these are just some common threads that have been seen. A research center here actually came up with a lot of these statistics as far as what they see. More likely to be obese or teased when young or even have a family history of obesity in their family. Obviously dieting to achieve a muscular body. And increased gender identity issues. Some studies have shown about 42% of males with eating disorders are gay or bisexual. Decreased sexual activity and an increase in sexual abuse. And increased weight-related sports, which we'll talk about in just a minute, but some common threads here are wrestling, running, and also just being able to see if someone is abusing steroids as well. That's a common theme here. And then finally, the separation or loss of a father. Also, some common signs that I've seen is body checking in the mirror over 50 times per day. 90% of the time reported thinking about working out, as well as when and what to eat and the amount of protein they will eat. And they don't see themselves as others see them. So again, it's very similar to anorexia, just within a different context, more focus on protein and muscles versus just being thinner and lower calories. Some of the gender differences are listed right here for you. And one thing I just want to kind of pull out is that women are dissatisfied from the waist down and men are dissatisfied from the waist up. Although, like I said before, equal percentage of both are unhappy with their bodies. Some compensatory methods are also different. We've seen that women are most likely to vomit. We don't see that as common in males, although we do see that. Men are less likely to use laxatives, so we see women using more vomiting, dieting, and laxatives. Men are most likely to use excessive exercise. This is the most common compensatory method for them. So again, moving towards a care plan, how do we care for men and how does that look different than our care that has been primarily established for women over the years? First, we work towards weight restoration if that is needed and work towards disrupting maladaptive behaviors. Also treating comorbidities, and the two most common comorbidities seen with men are also sexual addiction and chemical dependency. And then finally, we work to challenge irrational thought patterns and address male-specific issues such as body image, the difference of the body image struggle that they have, and the difference in the compensatory mechanisms, establishing a healthy exercise plan for them while screening for steroid abuse and working through that if that's a comorbid occurrence. And then finally, the underlying dynamics, which are often very different than for a female. And then we'll move into the eating disorders in childbearing years.
We want to focus now back on women specifically with eating disorders. Eating disorders in the childbearing years takes a look at women in midlife. And again, as I mentioned before, we are seeing an increase in eating disorders in midlife. Now, what is midlife? Midlife has been defined by researchers as ages 30 to 65. So many women with eating disorders in this range may have previously dabbled in disordered eating, and they have now progressed to a full-blown eating disorder, or maybe they had an eating disorder previously that never ceased, or maybe they began the eating disorder in midlife, and this eating disorder was triggered by a life transition. such as a career change, a divorce, dating again for the first time, children, many, many other changes that could take place. Women with eating disorders at these ages are more prone to medical complications such as infertility, so it's really important to take a look at some of these issues. What we most often see in this age group is pregorexia, desperate housewife syndrome, cyclic dieting, and lack of female role models. So let's take a look at pregorexia. Typically, women used to cease eating disorder behaviors during pregnancy, but now a small percent continue the behaviors during pregnancy. If you take a look at what we're seeing in the media, billboards, on ads, things like that, take a look at some of the maternity fashions that we are now seeing. They are so different from what we saw in the 70s and 80s. The maternity fashions are now sending the message that you must maintain your regular shape while you're pregnant, but just have this bump. So think of some of the magazine covers that you see in the grocery store when you're checking out. Anorexic or bulimic behaviors that occur during and after pregnancy. These behaviors are associated with the unnatural desire not to gain the 25 to 35 suggested pounds. So women are really trying to put that off. Pregorexia is affecting 5% of women, and it's indicated by a marked concern by weight control through extreme dieting and overexercising while pregnant. Moving on to the next slide, pregorexia is reinforced by comments about weight from friends and family, and what I would also put there as well is that it's reinforced by fashion magazines and things that we see on television. And the root of the disorder is based in control, perfectionism, or using the disorder as a coping mechanism to deal with difficult emotions and experiences. So the disorder itself becomes a way to cope with a changing body and life transition into parenthood. And we are also now seeing postpartum depression symptoms begin during the pregnancy and not always after. So real quick, what are some of the health risks? Anemia. Again, this is when the body does not have enough healthy red blood cells. Children with anemia are prone to infections and learning disabilities. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Rickets, which is a vitamin D deficiency resulting in weak, soft bones along with slowed growth and skeletal development. Heart disease, poor growth, and cognitive development. Cognition is the ability for one to think, process, and retain information. Additional health risks include a high risk of miscarriage and preterm delivery. Preterm delivery can certainly lead to a whole host of other problems, such as low birth weight, breathing problems, and heart problems for the infant. Microcephaly, this is a rare neurological condition in which the infant's head is smaller than the head of a child that same age and sex, and the result of the brain developing abnormally in the womb or not growing as expected after birth. Gestational diabetes, which is an increase in blood sugar levels during pregnancy. Preeclampsia and hypertension, increase in blood pressure. We see a higher rate of C-section deliveries, and we see low Apgar scores, and these scores are taken at 1 and 5 minutes after birth. And this is an acronym that measures appearance, pulse, grimace, activity, and respiration. And total scores range anywhere from 0 to 10, with 10 being the highest possible score. Additional studies, binge eating episodes are the most prevalent eating disorder behaviors reported during the gestational period, occurring in 25 to 44% in women during their first pregnancy. So binge eating becomes a way to cope with emotions as a result of hormonal changes, and some women use the pregnancy to justify the binge eating behavior. Women with bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, or high levels of perfectionism are at a higher risk of developing postpartum depression. So again, this is due to some of those self-imposed pressures to be a perfect parent, and women feel a guilt and shame when they cannot reach these unrealistic expectations. And lastly, how do we work with this population? Patients with eating disorders are counseled not to conceive until the eating disorder is in remission and the body can better handle and care for a pregnancy. We need clearer guidelines for obstetricians. This is one of those instances in which we would have a larger treatment team, and the treatment team would include an obstetrician, a dietitian, a therapist, psychiatrist, family members, spouse or significant other, and friends. And we would look for a possible support group in the area. Now, I know we do not have any in our area, but we certainly hope to see an increase in support groups for women in this age range as the number of women over the age of 40 having children is increasing. And lastly, desperate housewife syndrome. This is the pressure to maintain a youthful appearance and attitude. So think of the show. If anybody watched the show Desperate Housewives, I only saw it once or twice, but the show kind of sent the message that no matter what your age, you can have it all. Age does not immunize women from body image preoccupation and weight concerns, as has been thought in the past. So think, the majority of women in our society have some type of body image concern. In fact, disordered eating and a fear of aging go hand in hand. So eating disorders have become a way to cope with aging, as media and television are promoting maintaining a youthful appearance no matter what your age.
And so moving forward, looking at eating disorders in athletes, one thing that we've recognized is that this is seen much more common in judge sports versus refereed sports. You can see the different statistics here, 13% versus 3%, and 20% in elite sports versus 9% in the controlled population. And if you look at some of the common factors that you see between eating disorders and those findings in athletes, perfectionism, high self-expectation, being very, very driven, oftentimes compulsive, repetitive routines with food and exercise. And this is really, really difficult to kind of tease out how much of that is what helped them to get to their level of athletic ability. Because if you think of an athlete, you think of someone who's driven, who's determined, who works so hard until they're able to achieve that goal, which is oftentimes tied in what we also see in eating disorders with this perfectionism and this need to achieve. The concern with them is there's typically not a lot of reserve in an athlete. They already have a very lean body composition, not much stored body fat, very muscular. So we see damages affecting their body very rapidly, including their bone density, their menstrual cycles, their athletic performance. Their energy reserve is so low, and even in their lab work as well. Some of the most common sports that we see this affecting is dance, gymnastics, wrestling, jockeying, even running, cheerleading, swimming, diving. The common thread in a lot of these, again, is that they are rated, that it's a judged sport, and oftentimes very much based on what their appearance is, such as dance, gymnastics, swimming, and diving, and running. And then finally, we will move forward with these patterns of feeding disorders that are specific to the pediatric population. And kind of the main theme behind these, a feeding disorder becomes an eating disorder when it's affecting the child's growth. And listed here, I'll run through these quickly, are just different kind of subcategories that we see that are affecting children more commonly now. Food refusal syndrome and pervasive refusal syndrome are similar. It's essentially when the child is unwilling to care for themselves at all, and so that will often include refusing any liquids and refusing any food or nutrition. Functional dysphagia is fear of swallowing. Food avoidance emotional disorder is just the total avoidance of food altogether. It's an emotional disorder that, just like the term says, where the child will avoid food altogether. And selective eating and extreme fad dieting oftentimes is just anxiety with different types of food. And so these are becoming more and more common, and we're really having to tailor treatment towards pediatrics. We call them kind of like little mini eating disorders. And so where do we go from here? What can we do with this information? First and foremost, we need to continue to educate professionals in our communities regarding the risks of the eating disorder, the importance of working with an interdisciplinary team, and just how risky that this population is because of so many different co-occurring issues. Professionals in the eating disorder field need to stay current with all the research and media trends. We continue to rewrite this talk and reorganize this talk as more and more of these things become more popular and as these statistics increase. We need to provide education for families and friends and really support groups for family and friends. And so we'll finally leave you with this last quote. If you have the strength and ability to sustain an eating disorder, then you have the strength and ability to move beyond it. And that's what drives the work that we do and really allows us to continue to move forward in working with eating disorders. And you can see our additional information right here. If you would like to contact both Alicia or myself, we would be happy to answer any further questions. And that concludes our presentation. Thank you so much.
Now, to help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. Please respond by pressing the star key followed by the digit that corresponds to your choice. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Our first survey question, this session provided me with a better understanding of various eating disorder diagnoses. Star 1 for strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Or star 4, strongly disagree. We'll pause for a moment. Our next question. This session educated me on emerging trends in the area of eating disorders. Star 1 for strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. We'll pause again. Our third question. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Or star 4, strongly disagree. Our next question. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. And our final question, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. Or star 4, other. Thank you for your responses. At this time, we will conduct the question and answer session. If you would like to signal for a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Please be sure that your line is not muted so that your signal will reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. Again, that is star 1 to signal for a question. We'll pause for a moment. Again, star 1 for any questions. And we'll take our first question in our queue.
Yes, I was wondering if you could tell me if eating disorders has been labeled as an addiction.
There is some ongoing dialogue about that now. There is one school of thought where, yes, an eating disorder is an addiction, and some individuals do treat it as such. And one of the additional care plan indications would be for that individual to go to a 12-step type of meeting. There are some out there. Eating Disorders Anonymous does put on some 12-step meetings. The Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders Association does as well. And then there are some schools of thought as well that look at it and treat an eating disorder through a medical model.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And there are no other questions at this time.
Okay, well, we want to say thank you to everyone so much for attending, and a special thank you to Megan and Alicia for providing us with such wonderful insights today. If anyone from the call has specific questions about any of the therapies or treatments discussed today, please contact the eating disorder team by calling the number on the back of your Cigna insurance card. Please also be sure to mark your calendars to join our next eating disorder awareness seminar next month on Tuesday, September 24th, 2013 at 1 p.m. Eastern. That's noon Central and 10 a.m. Pacific. Thanks so much.
And that does conclude today's conference. Thank you all for your participation today.